This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 18th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we examine the architectural heritage of Alexandria and the built environment of its future.
We have effectively had no governance for 3 years. So these, the property developers, are just taking advantage of a situation where nobody is adhering to laws, or nobody's applying laws, or nobody's checking up on laws.
We meet the man behind the winner of last year's Design of the Year award, the designer of the UK government's website.
Britain in particular has a great heritage and history of brilliant public sector design projects. You know, the UK road signs that we refer to a lot, the tube stations, the tube maps, we've drawn quite a lot of inspiration from that and said maybe we could try and get some of that sort of culture back.
And we chat to the former president of the Royal Institute of British Architects at last week's international real estate show, MIPIM.
I think that we've got to think much more in a collegiate manner. I think we've got to think, how can we work together? How can we in London win further business abroad?
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Each spring, ambitious architects, property developers, mayors and city planners decamp to the city of Cannes on France's Mediterranean coast for MIPIM, the city's annual property trade show. As well as the lure of cocktails on La Croisette, the 20,000-strong crowd and 4,000 exhibitors offer a unique snapshot of the property industry as a whole, as well as a window into how our cities will look in years to come. Our very own Josh Fennett caught up with Angela Brady, the former president of the Royal Institute of British Architects at the London Pavilion, to discuss the importance of the event to the industry and London's prominence in the show so far.
Well, MIPIM is the fun place to be in March, for starters. It's a very good network, and I think a lot of the serious property investors are here, whether they be overseas or, in fact, from the UK themselves. But I think it's a place where you can exchange ideas as well. There's a lot of interesting talks. Most of the microphones are open, that people can add comments. Like I just added a comment there on housing for the Tottenham, the regeneration of Tottenham. And I am very concerned as an architect who specialises in social housing and mixed tenure housing that we're not creating the ghettos of the future, and that is the private ghettos. And I think that London, the essential thing about London is that it is diverse in its people and in its housing, and that is changing fast.
And London is obviously on everyone's lips. It's a bit of a headline city. There's a lot of big projects going on. There's a lot of money flying around. Everything from social housing projects to Jewel in the Crown, absurd big buildings that may never see the light of day. There's a lot of investment going on. I wonder, how you assess that situation. Is it one that's fraught with danger, or is it one that's good and is creating work for architects?
I think any inward investment into London is a good thing. I think we need people to see it as an asset, but we must be very careful how we react to foreign money coming in. If you look at any big chunks of money that are coming from China, from Russia, from the Middle East, how is that money being used? Is it for regeneration, or is it for a separate type of private generation? They're two different things. One is for the good of everybody, and the other is for the good of people who might visit 4 weeks a year. And I think that when you get the gentrification of a lot of areas, and you get the Kensington and Chelsea that are what I would call ethnic cleansing, if I'm being honest, pushing out the poorer people from a vital area of London that used to be quite mixed, and saying, sorry, only rich people can live here. And this affordable housing charade, you have to pay 80% of the going rate, whatever the going rate might be, which is usually very high. And with the rising prices now in London in particular, and the southeast of England, because of the housing shortage being caused by an inadequate government who are unable to provide social housing for whatever reason they have, which I don't agree with. I think that we have absolutely got to get the right investment good investment for the regeneration of the areas that have been lagging behind. And we have one of the most fantastic cities in the world. We've got the most creative architects in the world, architects, engineers and the full team. And I think that London is the place to be, but we've got to be so careful we don't destroy the very reason why people like it. And that's its diversity.
And it's a somewhat scathing review of the people who are in charge of making sure that the things you fear won't happen. That sort of came to a head earlier this week when a number of architects who were cycling from London to MIPIM were not mobbed, but they encountered protests. And it's quite an interesting time in London. Boris Johnson made a speech today.
Yeah.
Maybe in previous years austerity would have cost him that plane ticket and he wouldn't have been able to come. But, you know, it's a time for bandstanding. It's a time for talking big about London. I mean, I wonder how you see it going. Is it a case that if it's not regulated, you know, London will lose that vitality?
I think one of the problems is our banking system. Okay, I'm not going to go into the politics of banking, but there have been a lot of mistakes made in the past. And I think that any government has got to earn the trust of its people. And I think that it cannot be a top-down approach to the way we invest. We've got to listen to the people on the ground, the generations upon generations who have lived there for generations, to say, what is needed? The need is we need to regenerate the inner parts of, if we're talking London, the inner parts of London. Every borough needs a chance. There has to be this equality. There has to be the jobs. There has to be the creation and the opportunity for young practices and young entrepreneurs to get up off the ground and give them that kickstart to do things. London is being priced out of itself because of a lot of the type of investment that's actually taking in. Every investment they take in should have the equivalent of a Section 106 agreement, which is, what are you going to give back for the community? And I think that community should have a bigger say in what's happening. As regards the cyclists, I took part in the P2P, I did the Cross Ireland section there last July, raising money for good causes. Those guys and a few of the girls that were on that cycle, they were just fantastic. Over 4,400 miles from Portland, Oregon to Portland Place in aid of some very good charities. That has got to be commendable. People that show protests, I wasn't aware of the protests against the cyclists on the way down. MIPIM is a place where it's a network. It's a network where big businesses and where some of the boroughs and councils come here too, and they are looking for inward investment. If we don't have the investment at home, we need the investment from overseas, and this is a good place to get it. But it's, to me, it's got to be on the right grounds, and I think that's potentially quite possible.
And I'm just thinking that there might be a kind of silver lining to that. I mean, no one's saying that, you know, London is lost, but if London is viewed with such positivity in terms of the creativity it offers and also the wealth of experience and the wealth of skill of its own architects, is London being a headline in places like this also making business for the smaller practices? Are people coming here and looking for architects from London, do you think?
I think yes. On the RIBA London stand. Now, this is all very London-centric, which I'm not generally London-centric. I'm very much UK, all of UK. But as this is talking about London, let's talk about London. I think that the small practices, we've got 21 practices that are newcomers to being themselves. I'm one of them. Although I've been here before, I've come with a presidential hat. I've come as keynote speaker for Qatar 3 years ago. So I've come in different hats. Now I'm coming as, you know, a director of my own small practice, Brady Malilieu. And I'm hoping to find some business. Before, I would have been held back even handing out my card. Now I can actually be the same as that big practice here and say, hey, we've got skills, just like my colleagues. I'm introducing my colleagues. They're not competitors, really. I want them to get business too. I want to be able to set up consortiums with small, medium and large practices. I think that's the way forward. And I think that we've got to think much more in a collegiate manner. I think we've got to think, how can we work together? How can we in London win further business abroad? And here we have all of the stands from other countries. We have a unique selling point. That's our design skills, and the architects are at the heart of it. It's just unfortunate that the current government doesn't see that. We need a government that can see our talent is in raising standards and being leaders of the world. And we can do that. And architects are ones that can really help set that vision, paint that picture. This is what we need. This is the regeneration we can help. But too often we're left out of the picture.
So on a final note about the kind of regions, in a lot of the research I did, there were headlines in lots of regional papers in Nottingham, in Bristol, in Leeds, all of these places about sending representatives here and trying to find projects that would work for the cities. I've had a little walk around and these are not the busiest stands, unfortunately. What can they do to attract investment?
They can come down to our stand for starters, and they're very welcome. if they're allowed in. But no, I'll bring some of them in. We are too London-centric. But okay, Boris came down, he gave a good talk, he raised a few questions. You know, Boris is doing his thing for London and he's a good mouthpiece. I think what the others need to do is find, they shouldn't be seen as in competition with London, or we should be promoting them. And I think there is no harm in us promoting the good work that's going on in Nottingham or in Leeds or in Manchester or in Birmingham. They are all good cities, and I think that they should be given more say.
That was Monocle's Josh Fennett talking to Angela Brady, the former president of REBA and a director of Brady Malalieu Architects in London. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. While the parallels between nanotechnology and skyscrapers may not be immediately obvious to most, this week in San Francisco, Bloomberg Businessweek took a stab at connecting the dots. It was all part of the publication's second annual design conference. Billed as a forum where dozens of the world's smartest designers and entrepreneurs can share their insights, the one-day forum is a who's who of the design and tech worlds. Much of the chatter was about problem-solving, literally using technology and design to make our lives better. While most assume that to mean a better mobile phone or smarter refrigerator, there was one speaker who's taken on something that sounds far less cool and is arguably far more important. Enter Ben Tourette, who is the Director of Design for the UK Government's Digital Service. He and his team are the ones responsible for actually making a government website. Gov.uk makes sense. Our very own Tristan McAllister was at the Bloomberg conference and caught up with him.
It really does start with users and user needs, right? That's the thing, it's so simple. You know, it's why we don't need big strategy documents and this kind of stuff like that. You just focus on the user needs. What are the things people have to, you know, do? What the government requires them to do these things? What are the things they need to do, they have to do? What are they trying to do? And then we build out everything, you know, from that. So really it is just focusing on the users and the user needs.
In terms of efficiency, can you explain to me sort of the difference before and after for this sort of a system? I know you've implemented a lot of this in the UK already, and there was something there and now it's different. So what's the difference?
So people complete tasks way quicker than they used to. You know, we can measure that stuff. It's way more efficient, you know, in terms of cheaper. It costs the taxpayer less money. But in some cases, there are things that you couldn't do that you can now do online.
And in terms of just hallmark type things, I mean, one or two things that really stand out as good examples of what you've done?
Well, the bank holidays is a really easy one to describe anyway. So on the bank holidays page before, it was a list of all the bank holidays for this year, next year, you know, so on. And it's really important because government sets those public holidays, right? And they move slightly. You know, if Christmas Day falls on a Sunday, you know, the bank holidays on the Monday and so on and so on. And they move slightly and they're slightly different in Scotland, slightly different in Wales and so on. So it's really important government provides that information. And the page four is just a list of those, and you know, you would think it's quite hard to sort of get that wrong. But when we look, you know, because we have this huge user-centric focus, you look at the analytics and you look at the kind of search logs and that kind of stuff, everyone's arriving at that page having searched for when is the next bank holiday. So I don't know what the stats are, but like 90% of people just want to know when the next one is, right? So we just redesigned that page so that when the next one is huge and right at the front. And we still list all the other ones because, I don't know, say you'd bought a restaurant and you wanted to open it in the summer next year and you want to open it on the public holiday weekend, you know, that's all, you're planning a wedding or something, you know, that stuff's still important, but the thing that 90% of people want is that big kind of thing. And so we're just applying that thinking to, you know, everything, all kinds of services and transactions.
So that naturally begs the question that for years it was listed otherwise or in another way. Why didn't someone do this sooner?
So people have tried, I think, to do it sooner. And I think it's partly we're further down the line with digital technology than we were at various times, but I guess I don't really know why people didn't do it sooner, except that we've, you know, Martha wrote a fantastic report that gave us a really clear direction. We've got fantastic ministerial support that helps you get stuff done. So, you know, all these things kind of came together at the right time. It kind of helped that there's you know, it's just less money to spend on this stuff, you know, so you have to do things slightly differently. So, I mean, that's, I don't know why it didn't happen before, but that's why it's happening now.
And let's talk about that report. I mean, obviously there was this watershed moment where there was buy-in from ministers to think that this is the way it needed to be. What was that moment? What sort of led up to that?
Yeah, everyone asked that. And, you know, I think it is that user-centered focus. And, like, no one can argue with that. You know, focus on the users. No one ever says, oh, no, let's not do that. Let's focus on something else. So, you know, you don't have to convince people. You know, it's just really obvious and really straightforward. And everyone goes, yeah, that's a good idea. We should do that.
So then in terms of being a designer, you come from this background where you hadn't worked in this space, not for the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that an interesting line to jump over?
I've you know, worked for graphic design companies and ad agencies, and you know, very different. But Britain in particular has a great heritage and history of brilliant public sector design projects. You know, the UK road signs that we refer to a lot, the tube stations, the tube maps, you know, Bazalgette and the sewers, if you like. We have these great kind of public sector design projects, and maybe that stopped for a while, but when you look back through history, it's littered with these kind of things. And so we've drawn quite a lot of inspiration from that and said maybe we could try and get some of that sort of culture back.
You'd mentioned earlier in the conference that there are other governments around the world that are actually looking at your coding and looking at the platforms that you've developed and implementing them. Do you see this being scalable, and you clearly see it being well received?
Yeah, I mean, you hope it's scalable. Yeah, I mean, it's all open source, you know, deliberately. And, you know, governments around the world are doing the same things. You know, they're having this all the same sorts of transactions with their citizens. And there's no reason why they shouldn't build on the stuff, you know, we've done. I mean, New Zealand have taken our code and are doing that. We don't cover local governments. So there's a bunch of local councils in the UK who are doing the same thing now and doing their sites like that. And Honolulu's another one, you know, close to here that have kind of taken that stuff and doing that approach. And yeah, absolutely, we kind of encourage that.
Is there some indication that you've gotten that this is really working? Clearly, you know, people are going to the website, but anecdotally, what's coming back to you that makes you know that this actually makes sense for people?
Sure. Well, one nice little story is with one of our 25 exemplar transactions. This particular one is called the Lasting Power of Attorney. And typically what happens is often let's say your parents become, you know, quite seriously ill and you may have to take control of their financial affairs. And so this is the kind of transaction that is the legal process to do that. It's really complicated, you know, it's people do it at very stressful times. And we introduced the beta of that, and straight away the call center started getting phone calls saying, I just want to say this is a really great service, this is a great transaction. And they got so much of these phone calls that on the kind of dashboard that the call center people use, they've had to add a positive feedback button because they have to log each call and say what it was for, you know, and it's give guidance or complain about this or ask about fees or whatever that is. They've had to add a button to that system saying that call was about positive feedback because the amount of positive feedback they started receiving.
You have to wonder how many governments around the world get positive feedback like that.
Yeah.
Ben Tourette speaking to our Trista McAllister there. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris.
If you're in the diplomatic game, you could do worse than a posting in Rome, where you'll probably be put up in a palazzo fit for a pope. Monocle Films paid a visit to the ambassadors of Brazil and France.
Never before have embassies been so unloved. Budgets have been cut, buildings sold off. Sales of Ferrero Rocher have slumped. Yet in Rome, a sense of that almost lost tradition, a feeling for what diplomacy should look like, still very much exists.
When in Rome, premiering in the film section of Monocle.com.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Before moving to New York, Robert Standifer and Stephen Alesh of the Roman Williams Studio worked as set designers in Los Angeles for over a decade. Their experience turned out to be very helpful when they decided to open their own design firm in the East Coast in 2002. Not only because they got commissions from actors and directors they had previously worked with, but because of the unique theatrical sense of aesthetics they picked up in Hollywood and brought to New York's hospitality scene. The firm's milestones include the renovation of the Royalton Hotel, the design of the Standard Hotel, and the decoration of the Ace Hotel, including the Breslin Restaurant, all of which are now designed landmarks in Manhattan. Our New York bureau chief, Santiago Tarditi, met with Standifer and Alesh to talk about their latest projects.
In 2001, we were in Los Angeles working on a movie. Stephen and I met working in film and cinema. We created sets for movies for a decade together. And it was brewing for us that we might like to start to make some more permanent spaces. Because film is an incredible, fertile ground to kind of create space, but they get wiped away. I mean, they live on celluloid, but they don't live physically. So you don't see how things really age. And it was pretty important to us. So we were working on a movie in 2001 in LA called Duplex. The opening line of the script said, "This brownstone was pure architectural porn." And we were like, we want that job. So we had to build an incredible, like the most full-on, awesome Brooklyn brownstone in a stage in LA.
Well, what happened specifically when it was is that one of the actors came onto the set the day we were shooting, the set was finished. It was a beautiful set. Ben Stiller walks into the place and he looks around, taps on one of the walls. I think it was a tile wall. We built a big tile fireplace with real tiles that we had handmade. But he says, "My house is built cheaper than this." It was just such a funny, ironic moment. And then I realized we were at a point, we had to kind of bring what we were doing back to the real world because the real world had gotten so phony. So that was really the turning point. When we left that film, we never went back to another film. We just started scrounging for every job we could get, kitchen remodel, bathroom remodel, a birdhouse, barbecue in someone's backyard, anything we could get our hands on.
We started Roman Williams in L.A. in a little office at Paramount Pictures because we had connections in the movie business and we had a bunch of clients. We were lucky because we, you know, were connected to kind of a cool group of people that were young but had means. So we did houses for Ben and for Kate Hudson and just a kind of a great group of people who, it was interesting. And now, I guess I could have said this then, but when I look back now, I think, and we're all kind of friendly with all of them still, they were looking for not their mother's designer or architect. You know, they were like, "Oh, we kind of want to do it ourselves, but they're super busy," right? They had some cash and they were like, "But can you help us, but really help us create something that feels real for us?"
Why did you decide to move your operations from LA to New York? What triggered that move, and how did the city welcome you?
Well, we had left New York to go to LA because it's very hard to work in the film industry and not be in LA. And it's our client base was kind of living there, and Robin had a kind of an epiphany just saying, "I got to get back to New York, Stephen." Like, and I kind of missed it too. I loved it here. I'd only been here for 3 or 4 years before we went back to LA, so it just came calling and we dropped all of our projects. We had to start over.
Roman Williams was something that was about being able to have a real interaction, a public interaction, getting back to a public interaction. Because in a sense, in LA, what we were doing was making very private residences. For us, in terms of really building the company and having a constituency that we felt was really seeing things in a new way, a lot was going on in New York at that moment. You know, it was post 9/11, and there was just, it was a fertile moment to, I think, start a company with the ethos that we have and the values we have, which was, let's not think of design as this really precious, really overwrought, theoretical, academic idea. You're making places for people to live and people to eat, and those are really basic actions, functions that are part of an authentic life, and we didn't see a lot of that around us. I still think there's a big community of people in the design community that try a little too hard. And, you know, we fight against that. We have a big staff now. It was like the two of us in the living room. We have 25 people. We have a book. We're designing now. We're starting to design products. And we try to, you know, really keep those values. And I think in New York, because of the nature of the way the city has, of course, I think a very high-low mentality, I think it helps evolve, I think, the basic nature of our brand and our company to be here.
How is it different designing a private home and a public space like a hotel or a restaurant? And what are the challenges and the opportunities of both types of design?
Well, you know, a private home is so contained, it's so protected, you know, with the client, the husband, wife, kids, whoever lives in that place. And we cater to those clients so carefully. It's really about them. And the hotel environment, you know, there's always a client, but the client's just one out of now thousands and thousands of people that are going to come through. Everyone's guessing who this client is. You know, you could try to target certain people, but nobody really knows. It's just so opposite from a house. You're not building a trap in a house, a beautiful trap. You're building a protected kind of nest, right? And the hotel's more like a cup that's just waiting for something to walk into it, you know?
How do you avoid that your projects look like cookie cut, but retain your stamp, your mark?
Oh, it's, you know, we just try to keep moving, you know? We have go-to favorite things that are just part of, are in our hearts that we just love, you know, so we're never going to change. And those are the threads that people start to see after they see 8 projects in a row. They, I noticed that same detail, you know. These things are always going to be part of what we love. And these aren't new trends for us of like, oh, the last 2 years we discovered leather craft, you know. It's
but high and low also. helps change that. From the Breslin to the Boom Boom Room. Vogue once did a story that said a perfect night in New York. This was, to me, like my favorite thing ever written. Perfect night in New York was going from the Breslin to the Boom Boom Room. And people were like, oh, the same people did those two spaces? So it's also about turning the channels to not be so style-driven. I mean, you just don't like only one narrow thing. So we like a lot of things, right? We could like some strange gold, like creamy leather room, because it's one channel of glamour and decadence. But then also, like, we love a really earthy, hobbity space. And if you allow yourself to do, I think, those different projects and allow yourself the freedom to love those different things in your work and not only personally, you, I think, can have a variety, have an arc of different kinds of elements. I mean, I'm always sensitive, and sometimes we repeat ourselves because we want to, because we love something. And that, if there's criticism of that, again, I think it's people limiting the idea they always want you to be doing something new. So we don't abide by that, but we do think that you can like a lot of different kinds of things. And I mean, your readers, like, that's the whole same, that's your ethos. I love that.
It's true, there is a sense of that. I mean, is not to take ourselves too seriously, and we do have a sense of humor that creeps out here and there, and certain projects get earmarked for a little bit more playfulness, or it's a tough word to use, but repulsion. You know, where design isn't always about just fantastic, fantastic, amazing, oh, I love this, I love this. Sometimes you need to get it pushed back a little bit, and we like to push that thread. It's kind of secretive in our work that there's some provocation, repulsion. It's just as important as all this attraction kind of stuff. And I think that'll always be part of our work, and so we'll always be flirting with what people don't like.
I think that what is most important to us is a level of detail, whatever the style. And that is, I think, a critical starting point for us. I think really great people who are working in this world now and are global can't be style-based. I think it's just too limiting.
That was Robin Standifer and Stephen Alesh at the Roman Williams Studio speaking to Monocle's Santiago Tarditi. Still to come in this week's Section D, former Reba president Angela Brady tells our Josh Fennett what's what at this year's MIPIN Fair in Cannes. But now let's head to Canada, where our Toronto bureau chief Nelly Gotcheva reports on the retail and apparel scene of Vancouver. A mixed bunch, apparently.
The very first thing that strikes a new visitor to Vancouver is the obvious discrepancy between what you've been told about the street style of Canada's third largest city and the perfectly groomed men and high-heeled women rushing between meetings in downtown. There is no sign of the trainers and jeans combo that you heard was flooding the streets of Vancouver. This was maybe the case 10 years ago. Now, however, Vancouver impresses with an increasing number of independent retailers setting up shop in the city, well-traveled residents who definitely know how to dress, and locally based clothing brands that have made it big across the country and abroad. Among them is Herschel Supply. Jamie Cormack and his brother Lyndon launched the company in 2009. The concept was simple: well-made, good-looking, affordable backpacks. 4 years later, Herschel's line has grown into a full range of travel gear, wallets, tote bags, plus some exclusive collaborations with Liberty of London and Barney's New York. Today, nearly 50 people work in the headquarters in the industrial rail town area. One of them, of course, is Jamie Cormack himself.
Well, 4 years ago, we came up with the idea to come up with a new bag brand called Herschel. You know, it was basically taking some of that nostalgic style, modernizing it with today's features inside, kind of narrowing the bag out, lengthening it so it just fit your silhouette a bit better, and launching it with a lifestyle and with marketing, and really put a lifestyle behind it, because we found ones that was the other thing that was lacking. Although there might be a great bag out there, it didn't have the lifestyle or the feeling or truly the marketing behind it. And that's something that we were really passionate about. We're both passionate about photography and fashion and the outdoors, and we really wanted to bring all that together in a bag company.
What are some of the newest markets, international markets, that you're targeting right now?
International markets we're targeting, we're in. Great question. I wish Lynn was sitting beside me because he has a lot. But I think the growth and what we've really been concentrating is, you know, Korea is a really up-and-coming market. We're doing a lot over there, and we have great partners over there. Japan is still growing. Obviously, the China thing comes up a lot with people. We're at the brakes on China still right now. We have great partners in Hong Kong. We sell some top doors in Shanghai and Beijing as far as like streetwear and lifestyle fashion go, but we really don't sell into China other than that. So it is one that we're exploring partnerships and a plan, but it's a giant. We want to make sure if we do it right. You know, obviously, we know there's growth there, but we want to make sure that we do it properly. And in all of our, with our distributors and our growth has been with the right people. We're planning out, you know, not just 2 years ahead, we're planning out 5 to 10 years and who we're going to partner with and how we're going to get there.
It's not such a well-known fact that you're actually based in Vancouver and you started in Vancouver, and for sure it comes as a surprise to a lot of people to find out that Herschel, being so well-known internationally right now and making it big across the world. So what is your take on Vancouver's design scene and style and manufacturing?
Okay, Vancouver. I mean, Vancouver has changed so much. There are so many great designers, architects, design firms, new clothing companies, shops. To me, it's the best place to live in the world. You can't ask for a more beautiful city, a city on the water, a city that just, I think it just lends itself to being creative. As far as Vancouver, I truly believe there's been so many global brands to come out that's really helped us and helped Vancouver go on the map. Being a Canadian company, we never felt it was holding us back at all. It was just going out there and just telling our story. It's interesting being from here because it's a little bit, we'll say, harder to hire in the sense that you're not based in a manufacturing hub or in a design hub. But we have great people and a lot of international people working under the roof as well, which is great.
A 10-minute car ride from Herschel's offices is the recently opened showroom of Wings and Horns, just blocks away from the company's factory. This year, the high-end outerwear maker is celebrating its 10th anniversary. Founder Craig Atkinson is giving us a tour of the space. He also tells us all about the new collaborations planned for later this year.
Wings and Horns has always been a destination brand, I feel. We were sort of known in the past for our stealth marketing. We just didn't market ourselves. We wanted people to find us for what we were, look at the product. So I think that keeps in line with our core values as a brand. Generally speaking, when someone comes to the retail store, they're a serious customer and they're here to experience the product and buy something.
You are based in Vancouver, you started in Vancouver. You still have a lot of your production happening in Vancouver, a couple of blocks down from your showroom. So how do you find local fashion market in terms of manufacturing and brands that are made here?
Considering the fashion market in Canada in general, the menswear market has been growing. However, it is very difficult to produce product here. Canadian brands are producing offshore. One of the reasons why we started our own facility was to be able to control our quality. So I think for us, it's been an integral part of our brand. It's allowed us to keep our quality in check. It's just part of the ethos of the brand right now. I'm not sure how that connects with other brands in the marketplace, but brands that are close to us that we've worked with, like Arc'teryx, they produce still locally, internationally as well, but sort of spending several years producing for Arc'teryx, it really showed me how they grew their brand close to home, making it locally before they went into international markets.
And speaking of your products, can you just tell me something more about your latest spring collection?
You know, this is our 10th anniversary this year. So 2014 marks our 10th anniversary. We sort of reached back into where Wings and Horns came from. I was spending a lot of time in Japan at the beginning of the brand. A lot of my influence in fashion came from Japan. In spring 14, we really did a lot of material research from Japan. And in particular, something I can sort of share with you is something called sashiko, which is basically the Japanese, back in the 17th century, they used this technique to strengthen materials, to give them warmth in some cases. This was worn by fishermen and farmers in the 1950s. So we took from that fabric and we did our own version of it. Of course, more contemporary styles today. We did like a men's jacket, a shirt, a short. So I think that's one of the highlight styles this season that I'm quite excited about.
When it comes to fashion and design, Vancouver remains somehow under the radar. But with over 200 apparel companies accounting for 7% of the local economy, the city surely has a great potential. And we can hardly wait to see what else Vancouver has to offer. For Monocle, in Vancouver, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Thanks, Nelly. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24. You're with Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Alexandria is a city of five races, five languages, a dozen creeds, or at least according to writer Lawrence Durrell in his acclaimed Alexandrian Quartet. This reference to the cosmopolitan makeup of the city also reflects its impressive architectural legacy, which was shaped by the various nationalities and religions that inhabited Egypt's second city during the 19th and early 20th centuries. They included Italian, French, Greek, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim. Today, few of these buildings remain, and those that do are often in the shadow of the many high-rise blocks that were constructed to house the population increase that the city witnessed in the 1970s. More recently, the widespread illegal building that has accelerated across Egypt since the revolution of 2011 has had a catastrophic effect on the built environment of the city, with numerous important buildings being destroyed and replaced by poorly constructed but profitable apartment blocks. Edward Lewis went to Alexandria to find out the extent of the damage and what is being done to save this unique architectural heritage.
I'm in Alexandria, or Alexandria, as it is known in Egypt. A city with an incredibly rich history, dating from its foundation by Alexander the Great to its Belle Epoque era of the 19th and 20th centuries, characterized by its unique architectural legacy of wide boulevards, ornate villas, and grand public facades. Today, this urban fabric is in real danger, as a combination of inadequate legal protection, exploitation of Egypt's political situation, and limited law enforcement threaten their existence. Dr. Mohammed Awad, director of the Alexandrian Preservation Trust, who has dedicated his life to documenting and preserving these buildings, explains why the city's built heritage is so important.
In the modern period, Alexandria was one of the greatest cosmopolitan cities of the world. And the Alexandrian experience continued to be cosmopolitan all through the 19th and up to the mid-20th century, actually. So we have 150 years of cosmopolitanism and cosmopolitan heritage in the city that portrays the diversity, the interaction between the different communities. So we have, you know, what the Greeks were building and what the Italians were building, what the British were building, what the French were building, in a city which portrayed this multicultural interaction.
Walking the streets of the old city centre, it is not hard to admire the style and scale of these buildings, a great many of them testament to the rich cultural legacy that Lawrence Durrell, E.M. Forster and others were part of. Colin Clement, a resident of the city for over 25 years, observes the scene from his balcony and what is becoming of these important landmarks.
The area where we are sitting right now is in the heart of what could be the modern town. Looking across from the balcony, you can see what was the Greek hospital in the late 19th century. Looking to the right of us, we see the Church of San Saba, which is the patriarchal church of the Greek Orthodox. Looking to the left of us, we can see the building in which Constantine Gavafis, the famous poet, lived for about 30-odd years. So we are right downtown, and this area is being transformed quite radically, especially in the past 3 years. All tenement blocks, four stories, are being pulled down to be replaced by 15, 16-storey blocks.
Limited space and an ever-expanding population has meant real estate downtown is at a premium. The old, low-rise buildings are being targeted for demolition to be replaced by far more profitable apartment blocks that transform the landscape and suffocate the surroundings. Powerful construction companies with plenty of cash is one issue, but since Egypt's revolution of 2011, demolition of important buildings has accelerated. Colin Clement again.
We have effectively had no governance for 3 years. So these, the property developers, are just taking advantage of a situation where, you know, nobody is adhering to laws, or nobody's applying laws, or nobody's checking up on laws.
Perhaps the most prominent example of the damage to the city's identity occurred this February, when the Villa Aguillon was severely damaged. Built in 1928 by the renowned French architect Auguste Perret, and considered one of the city's finest buildings, it too became victim of development despite the fact Perret's buildings in France are protected by UNESCO. That this is allowed to happen legally has forced many, including Dr. Awad, to seemingly give up hope.
What remains really is the city centre. And if the city centre goes, we have nothing left. It is grim. And we're fighting the battle, but I think we are going to lose the war. I have been frustrated, and I will live with the frustration. And there's only one glimpse of light, is that there are a few young people that are taking the lead now, and they are defending the heritage of the city, and that there is more exposure to awareness and more interest in preserving what is left of the city.
Amongst these groups is Save Alex, a volunteer organization established by two young architects, Ahmed Hassan and Mohamed Abu Khir, and supported mainly by students. Here Ahmed explains the group's objectives.
Save Alex is an initiative that want to protect our built heritage within the umbrella of enhancing the built environment. It's not separating these two issues from each other. We are trying to do this through raising awareness about the issue and by protecting buildings by protests and going to the media, and by facilitating the stakeholders that are involved in this issue to get together and find solutions to make a win-win situation.
They face an uphill battle. There is a list of protected buildings, but loopholes in the legislation in place to protect buildings of historical value are enabling contractors to target these buildings, remove them from the list, and therefore demolish them legally. Ahmed Hassan again.
The amount of buildings that are delisted now are like 36 or 38, and the amount of number of buildings that are now in court and can be delisted also, like 92. This is on Alexandria only. You can see what the size of the phenomena all over Egypt.
Rallying to protect these buildings is not without its dangers. Often secured by hired thugs, trying to document, take photographs, or even sketch buildings can result in unwanted confrontation. Mohamed Goha, a young architect who has established a project to sketch Alexandria's important buildings, describes one such episode.
Once I was in Rushdie, some narrow street. I was sketching an old building related to the Greek society. Mm-hmm. It's already demolished. I just took a photo with my mobile and I started to... Normally I do outlines to the building with a photo and I continue the details when I go back. So I took the photo and I've started to draw the outlines of the building. So already what remaining of the remains of this building. Suddenly I found just two big guys. They caught me and took the mobile. And I started to ask why you are doing that. They told me some from the government or I don't know what. And they took the mobile, erased the photo and took the sketch and cut my paper.
Ahmed Hassan echoes this concern.
We will be threatened or endangered by many of them or some of them because we are interfering with their business. And if not the regular ways will do this thing, I think they will come to their ways by using mobs or threat or something like that. I think so.
Whilst the youth movement is admirable, and the energy and enthusiasm a reason to have some optimism for Alexandria's heritage, the power of the construction companies, the wealth at their disposal, and the lack of law enforcement has already meant a great many buildings have been lost forever. With no apparent will for improved protection and legislation, Alexandria's legacy may very well soon disappear, and with it, testament to a remarkable chapter in Egypt's history. For Monocle, in Alexandria, I'm Edward Lewis.
You're listening to Section D. I'm Tom Morris. At Paris's Ville Plant Exhibition Park, fabric trade show Premier Vision acts as a key platform for attendees to discover the latest innovations in fibre and fabric developments, as well as the trends, major directions and key themes that will help conceive and develop the following season's collections. Monocle's Timothy Anscombell was on hand to speak to the organisers and suppliers and to get an inside line on a new showcase, Premier Vision Istanbul, which will launch for the first time in the Turkish city this October.
Twice per year,
fashion buyers, designers, and industry insiders descend on the Parc des Expositions in the northern suburbs of Paris. Première Vision sits as a key upstream event where manufacturers and suppliers display their wares, orders are made, and industry trend gossip is exchanged. The patterns and prints that prove popular here will make their way onto the runways of Milan, Paris, and London in 6 months' time, before hitting boutiques and stores the year after. First, I caught up with Philippe Pasquet, CEO of the trade show, about the state of the market and about his decision to launch a new biannual event in the Première Vision network. Première Vision Istanbul from the 29th of October this year.
There is a new sense of optimism at the moment. Actually, ourselves at Première Vision, we have felt that before. We are upstream, so it means that we are ahead of the other operations, the catwalks and the apparel menswear like Pitti Uomo. So the impact of a better economy, of better fashion, we usually feel it before. So we are focusing our offer on the most sophisticated, most creative manufacturers, or designers, studios, etc., etc., depending on the show, but they are all selective, and ideas in fashion are not widespread everywhere in the world, at least so far. So there are some very important countries. The main one, generally speaking, is Italy. France is also important. The UK is important, especially for the designers. That's the main exhibiting country for Indigo. And there are some very good players in Japan, etc., etc. But we are talking of something between 30, 40 countries. There are producers of textile and design in a more limited number of countries than garment manufacturers or fashion brands.
And Turkey in particular is an exciting country to watch at the moment in terms of textiles, in terms of manufacturing. You're launching the first Première Vision in Istanbul, I believe it's in October. Could you tell me a little about that, why it made sense to do that now?
Turkey is a very important country in the textile world. It has been a very important country for decades, because there is a tradition of textile manufacturing and garment manufacturing in the country for a long time already. The production base in the country is really going upward in terms of quality, creativity, etc. So there are very good suppliers on the medium and medium-high segment of the market. That's the positioning of Première Vision. And Istanbul is a very interesting city and is moving ahead also with a very dynamic airline company, Turkish Airways, with many hotels in the city and a key place.
Next, the show's fashion director, Pascaline Wilhelm, ran me through a few of the colour and print trends we can expect to be ubiquitous over the coming seasons.
For the prints, we have different kind of trends, and we have obviously the flowers. And this it's really interesting because this season the flowers are a lot of different flowers put together, and a new way to be modern. You know, they are absolutely not romantic, and it's a new way to show flowers in one part, and the other part is more gestural and more drawing. More the notion of pencil and to draw directly, to be nervous with the design of the lines. It's a very beautiful realization here shown in Première Vision.
And could you tell me a little about the color trends that you're seeing at the fair at the moment?
The color trends this season are really interesting because they are not exaggerated. We put the fluo and all these very hard colors out, and we have a notion more savor, with more intense, I don't know, sugar color, and very not romantic, and they want to be a little provocative with their own color.
An area known as Maison d'Exception is the trade fair's platform for revealing the ultimate in innovation and creativity within the industry. Pascal Gautran, the consultant responsible for curating the mix of specialist manufacturers, explained why this showcase was a key addition to the fair.
In the past, let's say 5 years, Most of the luxury houses and a lot of designers have been really putting the emphasis on increasing the quality of the product by choosing more specific and very high level know-how and combining them with their own creativity to get to a type of product that is barely difficult to, let's say, copy or imitate. We now see a lot of houses that are coming back to some very small scale productions, unique pieces, sometimes made to measure, of course, or personalized for high-end customers. Mm-hmm. So both those phenomena pushed Première Vision into willing to create a link between, on one side, very small producers all over the world who are in charge of developing very different techniques also, from knitting to weaving to printing, embroidery maybe. We try to give a definition of the variety that the exceptional know-how can mean. It can be something really artisanal, it can be something more industrial, it can be very traditional or very innovative, and what we try to demonstrate is that the mix of all those elements is enriching the system.
As buyers and designers milled about the 700 odd stands in the main hall, they were all on the lookout for fresh patterns and prints from their suppliers. With the buzz of the crowd and the brands competing for their attentions with increasingly innovative offerings, it will be interesting to see if these results are replicated for their new event in 6 months' time. That was Timothy Anscombell's report from Première Vision in Paris, bringing us to the end of Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Aled at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show, if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And playing you out with some French sounds after a French fabric fair is MC Solar with La Belle et la Bad Boy. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Ils étaient rencontrés sur les bancs de l'école, entre une heure de colle, de maths ou un cours d'espagnol. C'était une fille fun, fana de football, lui ne craignait pas les balles, c'était le goal. Ce qu'il lui promettait, c'était des balades en corvette, pour l'instant en survette. Il volait des mobilettes, mais entre eux c'était toujours complicité. Escale sur un piédestal, un rêve délimité. S'il devenait triangle, elle serait rectangle. La belle et le bad boy, le triangle rectangle, c'est comme...